Arab and Israeli diplomats at the UN have spoken of recorded interviews with captured personnel, which would prove charges that the other side bears responsibility for the war. No such recording has yet been offered to the Security Council. Today in Tel Aviv, the Israelis released what they termed a recording of a radio telephone conversation between President Nasser of Egypt and King Hussein of Jordan, in which the two men decided to assert that U.S. and British forces had helped the Israelis administer a stunning defeat to Arab forces. Washington and London have repeatedly denied the charges. From the Israeli version of the Arabic conversation, it would seem the plan to accuse the U.S. and Britain was Nasser's, and that most of King Hussein's answers were unintelligible. Bill Ryan, NBC News, New York.
Crisis in the Middle East. NBC News presents Crisis in the Middle East. Here is Morgan Beatty.
The great powers of the world are confronted tonight, assuming that the Arab nations and Israel do ultimately honor the ceasefire they have accepted. The great powers are confronted with a greater nightmare of proliferation and the danger of world nuclear holocaust than appeared likely before the Middle East crisis began. The Egyptian false charges against British and American planes, the Israeli attacks so far recklessly unexplained on United Nations soldiers and on American soldiers or sailors, these together show the dimensions of great danger. As one survey shows, under the Institute of Strategic Studies in London, the danger of proliferation of all kinds of armaments among the Red Chinese and the smaller non-nuclear powers of the world, the danger multiplies peril by the square and the cube root. In 1 week, there have been four dangerous miscalculations by the Israeli and the Egyptians and Jordanians. These miscalculations, any one of them, could have plunged the whole world into a swift escalation of military action. The only preventive was the steady mind and hand of the leaders of the four great powers, the United States, Britain, Russia, and France. The first danger was provided by the Israeli Air Force snaking its way toward the Suez Canal, and their ground forces killed 11 United Nations soldiers, 8 of them from India, in an attack that has not yet been explained. Did they think the UN force waiting for repatriation was an Egyptian column in disguise, or did some trigger-happy officer simply say, shoot anything armed that appears to be dangerous? Nobody knows. The second grave danger, worse than the Israeli error, appeared on the Jordanian radar screen at the very beginning of hostilities early Monday morning. Jordanian radar officers reported veritable clouds of planes leaving Egyptian shores and flying low to return to American and British carrier bases in the Mediterranean. These reports were false, but they were relayed to the Egyptians, who already suspected the terrible fact that attack planes were destroying their air force. Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt waited hardly a moment for confirmation. The Israelis say they intercepted a conversation between Nasser and King Hussein of Jordan, in which the two men agreed to say American and British planes were flying air cover for the Israeli air forces. The Israeli intercept does not make clear whether Hussein and Nasser were making an honest mistake, but that's not important. What is important is that both of them accepted impulsively and angrily, accepted false information. And by Israeli count, their own air force, some 450 planes strong, caught all the Arab air forces against them on the ground, mostly, and destroyed fighting power. Experts in the Pentagon in Washington, analyzing all of this, suspect the facts are that the Israeli intelligence service provided Israeli flyers with gaps in the Egyptian radar system. Israeli pilots swept out of Israel across ocean space to avoid ground fire, and then moved back in coastwise in Africa, threaded their way through Egyptian radar. After their attacks, they flew back out to sea in another big half circle, again to avoid ground fire. And that departure was what the Jordanian radar spotters saw. Again, the point is, Nasser trumpeted his charges against the United States and Britain to the world. He closed the Suez Canal. Arab nations everywhere cut off oil to the West on false information. And the big question was raised by Nasser's man in Moscow with the Russians. Will the Russians please intercede directly in the war to counterbalance the Western powers? Unknown to Nasser, Premier Kosygin of Russia used the hotline to Washington to ask for an explanation of all of this. Second, his own spy ships close to our 6th Fleet and the British forces in the Mediterranean, had reported no war flights by our planes or by the British. Kosygin refused to accept Nasser's charges. The same kind of steady-on-the-tiller reasoning appeared high in the United Nations and Washington councils when the Israeli, as India charges, wantonly killed United Nations soldiers in the early hours of the war. And late today, the White House decided the reckless belligerence playing with nuclear fire had to be revealed to the world public. The time had come to throw ice-cold water into the faces of the leaders on both sides. The White House called in reporters. Press officer George Christian revealed that the president had once again called Premier Kosygin on the hotline, that Kosygin himself had used on Monday. He explained that our carrier planes had scrambled today and were streaking east through Mediterranean waters to help rescue an American communications ship 15 miles off the Sinai Peninsula, some 90 miles southwest of Tel Aviv, Israel. The president did not want the Russian leader to believe that our planes were mixing in the war itself. The reason for the president's anxiety had become apparent earlier today in a Pentagon briefing of what happened to our ship. Here is Carl Stern, NBC News correspondent in Washington.
Officials at the Defense Department had no explanation of the Israeli attack on the American communications ship USS Liberty. The ship was flying U.S. colors. The attack came in clear weather 15 miles off the coast of Egypt, first when Israeli jets 6 times strafed the former Liberty ship. A further account from Pentagon spokesman Phil Goulding.
Some 20 minutes later, 3 torpedo boats approached the Liberty on its starboard quarter. At least 2 torpedoes were fired by these boats. The Liberty fired at 1 torpedo with its 50 caliber machine guns. 1 torpedo passed approximately 25 yards astern of the Liberty, and about 1 minute later, the ship sustained a torpedo hit on its starboard side.
10 U.S. Navy crew members were killed in the attack. Approximately 100 were wounded, 20 of them critically. Spokesman Goulding said also that 8 American jet bombers with supporting fighter cover were launched from U.S. aircraft carriers, but were called off when a message of error and apology was received from Tel Aviv. The incident paralleled the killing earlier this week of 8 Indian soldiers, part of the U.N. emergency force awaiting evacuation in the Gaza Strip. Their identity was also visible, but the thrust of jet-age war in the Middle East has claimed both friends and enemies. Use of the Washington-Moscow hotline to explain where U.S. jets were headed today, in this case to assist the Liberty, is itself testimony to fear any response to an even minor military error could touch off a larger incident involving the major powers. There were indications today Israeli planes striking Egypt from the sea to avoid radar detection may in fact have been mistaken 2 days ago by Egyptians as American planes from the carriers of the 6th Fleet. Mistaken identity and reckless or unexpected military activity can spread war to the major powers, and there was no doubt today that the Pentagon and the White House are worried about it. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
Combine the reckless actions of Nasser and the Israeli armed forces, and we reach the reason why both Russia and the United States are trying together to drive a bargain with the non-nuclear powers over proliferation of weapons. The basic facts are revealed by the American Assembly, a non-political, non-partisan educational institution. It has just published an intensive deep study of the question of the spread of weapons. The book officially reveals that between 12 and 15 nations have both the nuclear know-how and the means of delivery for nuclear weapons in any war. These include Sweden and West Germany and India and Japan. In addition, France and Red China have already joined the nuclear club but refused to sign a non-proliferation treaty proposed by the United States and Russia. Now the non-nuclear nations must face the fact of international life. As editor Alastair Buchan has said, they must face the nightmare of proliferation and peril. The leaders of 3 non-nuclear nations have committed ghastly miscalculations in a single week of war in the Middle East, and they have used sophisticated American, British, French, and Russian systems provided to them to help them escalate their trigger or emotion-happy foolishness. At the United Nations today, desperate measures were undertaken, without much success, to dampen the fires of war, prevent proliferation. Here is Wilson Hall, NBC News, at the United Nations.
Delegates to the United Nations like to appear as though nothing surprises them. This afternoon, they had a difficult time keeping up that appearance. The big surprise came from the United Arab Republic, the announcement that Cairo agreed to a ceasefire if Israel stopped shooting, something Israel had already said it would do. It took hours for Cairo radio to catch up with the UAR announcement in the United Nations. It probably will take many more hours for delegates to get readings from their governments on why the delay between the UN announcement of a ceasefire and word out of Cairo announcing the same thing. Sources here tell me that the most surprised man was the UAR ambassador Mohammed El-Khoni. El-Khoni had a 20-page speech under his arm outlining the reasons why Egypt would not stop shooting until the UN condemned Israel for starting the war and demands that Israeli troops return to lines they held before the shooting started early Monday morning. A few minutes before the UAR ambassador was to give that speech, a call from Cairo said, "Announce we do accept the ceasefire," and the announcement was made. The backstage whisperings about the announcement took the spotlight away from the more important long-range differences between the United States and Russia on what can and should be done about the future in the Middle East. The Russian ambassador, clearly outlining the Arab view, insisted that the UN, quote, vigorously condemn Israel's aggressive activities and demand that Israel withdraw its troops to positions behind the armistice lines. The U.S. resolution, presented by Ambassador Arthur Goldberg, wants only a ceasefire for all parties concerned, including the Arab nations who have declared war on Israel and have not yet agreed to a ceasefire. The U.S. also wants discussions on withdrawal and disengagement of armed personnel, but pointedly does not say anything about a withdrawal to where. At issue in the differing resolutions is one of the main points of difference between the Arabs and the Israelis: freedom of navigation for the Gulf of Aqaba and the Suez Canal for Israeli ships and Israel-bound ships. The Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban welcomed the Egyptian acceptance of the ceasefire. Eban also suggested that Israel would rather talk directly with Arab nations about the future of the area than have the UN act as a third party. Clearly, both Israel and the Arabs think the United Nations has done them little good in the past. Yet, both are talking about their war and the reasons for it here at the United Nations. Wilson Hall, NBC News, at the United Nations.
The war itself in the Middle East is easily described in general, but not in detail. Most of the communiques from Tel Aviv and Cairo are concealing more than they tell. For example, neither Israeli nor Egyptian forces, so far as is known, have stopped the fighting, even though their governments have officially accepted a ceasefire. Neither side is giving the number of prisoners or the dead or the wounded. Both sides, one way or another, all but admit that the Israeli Air Force, possibly at a loss of nearly 100 of its 450 planes, has in fact destroyed the Egyptian Air Force and the small Jordanian and Syrian Air Forces. They have wrecked or trapped about half of Nasser's powerful 1,200 tank and armored force supplied by the Russians. The Israeli are in a position to control both the Suez Canal and the Gulf of Aqaba, but they have not moved to control the canal, merely the Gulf, and ships are moving through. And a great vacuum of power has been created. Nothing has been done for the 1.25 million Arab refugees whose daily United Nations rations have been cut off. The stoppage of the Suez Canal and the stoppage of oil deliveries from Middle East fields have created a temporary world crisis in oil. Here is Peter Hackis, NBC News in Washington.
Whenever there's a major crisis in the Middle East, there's a major crisis in that region's chief export, oil. As of this evening, six Arab nations, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Libya, Kuwait, Iraq, and Algeria, have stopped exporting oil. Oil from neighboring Iran has been cut off, too, because Iraqi ship pilots refuse to handle any cargoes bound for the U.S. or Britain. And to further complicate matters, the Suez Canal is closed down, through which this vital Middle East product has been flowing at the rate of about 4 million barrels a day headed for Europe and the Western nations. Only about 3% of the oil used in this country comes from Arab oil wells. But almost half of the oil used by our military forces in Vietnam comes from there, most of it shipped directly by tanker. So once again, as during the Iran crisis of 1951 and the Suez Affair of 1956, we are faced with the possibility of a temporary oil emergency. Today, here in Washington, officials of the 20 biggest U.S. international oil firms, Standard Oil, Gulf, and the others, met with government officials. The group is called the Foreign Petroleum Supply Committee, and its job is to come up with alternate oil supplies, tankers and refinery capability, and an overall emergency plan, which the committee is now working out at the government's request. One government source tells NBC News the most likely place to get additional oil would be Venezuela, Trinidad, and from Aruba in the Dutch West Indies. In addition, he says, U.S. oil fields in the Gulf of Mexico are not operating at capacity and can produce much more. So there is enough oil to be had. The big job is to line up the tankers to get it, and the refineries to make it into gasoline, jet fuel, and the like. One Pentagon official says there's enough oil on hand right now to keep the U.S. military in action for many weeks. Long before then, emergency alternative supplies will have been tapped. Meantime, it's emphasized, no oil emergency has been declared here at home, and there's no need to ration gasoline. One of the problems in this situation, a problem the Petroleum Committee faces, is whether to actually get going with those alternate emergency sources if the Arab nations are about to sign an armistice and presumably resume the flow of oil. That, of course, is strictly an unanswerable question tonight. As one official put it today, the longer the oil countries hold out, the more money they themselves lose. Hopefully, he says, it won't be long enough to force the emergency operation plan into active use. Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
In addition to Arab refugees in the Middle East, there are some 60,000 Europeans and Americans in the danger zone. Many governments are trying hard to get their citizens out of harm's way. 12,000 Americans out of the 40,000 in 14 Middle Eastern countries are on the move. Here, censored by the Egyptians, is NBC News correspondent Edward Scott in Cairo.
The government of the United Arab Republic has offered to facilitate all travel arrangements and to cooperate in securing the safety of several hundred Americans scheduled to be evacuated from this war zone on Saturday. This assurance was given in a U.S. Embassy note circulated among Americans who have been assembled for 2 days at the Nile Hotel. There is another group of Americans at the Hotel Nile Hilton, also awaiting evacuation. After the formalities have been completed, those Americans also will be transferred to the Nile. Once in the Nile Hotel, they are not allowed to leave. The Americans say, however, that they are being treated correctly and understand that the strict security restrictions are due to the high anti-American feeling here because of alleged U.S. aid to Israel in the present war with the Arab states. A special train for 500 people has been chartered by the U.S. government. It will transfer the evacuation group to Alexandria on Saturday, where the Americans will board a specially chartered ship, the Carina, for the voyage to Greece. The most dissatisfied members of the group are about 30 U.S. correspondents who were not given any option. The Egyptian government simply ordered them to leave. Edward Scott, NBC News in Cairo.
From other sources, it is learned that Cairo is a city of quiet fear. Troops are moving in many directions, but why is not known. Now, a report from the Center of Victory. Here is NBC News correspondent Alvin Rosenfeld in Tel Aviv.
The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is safe and sound. This afternoon, I visited the ancient church, which marks the spot where the Bible says Mary brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and placed him in a manger. I found that the church was untouched by the fighting which had flared in the Judean hills surrounding Bethlehem. This, in the eyes of some men, may be considered a miracle, for an artillery shell had landed within a few feet of the church during the warfare and had burned two automobiles parked nearby. They stand there now, nothing but metal skeletons. But the Church of the Nativity itself is peaceful, and Israeli soldiers walk in carrying guns over their shoulders, but acting like tourists do everywhere. Most of the shops in Bethlehem are still closed, but those which are open are now accepting Israeli currency instead of Jordanian money. Alvin Rosenfeld, NBC News, Jerusalem.
And thus we hear the voice of victory in Jerusalem and in Israel. But elsewhere, the voice of peace is the one that's needed. Perhaps the world outside of the war zone is in a mood to listen to the voice of peace. That voice came today movingly in the United Nations. Lord Caradan of Great Britain asked the people of the world to pay heed. Listen to him.
In the crisis and the challenge which we now face, I appeal both to the members of the Council and the parties to the conflict to realize and accept that international authority must be established. I appeal to them to realize that this cannot be done by sitting in New York and passing resolutions That is necessary, but is not nearly enough. It is on the ground, in the deserts, and the hills, and the villages, and cities of the Near East that action is required. There must be, in the areas of conflict, effective United Nations representation to cope with all the tasks ahead of us. What are those tasks? To stop the fighting, and we pray that the fighting may very soon be stopped. To ensure and secure disengagement, to bring relief and succor to the wounded and the homeless, and then to move on to the greater tasks of conciliation and the establishment of order and justice. And these practical tasks are enormous. They will occupy us for a very long time to come. Mr. President, I most earnestly and sincerely beg all members of this council, especially the permanent members of this council, to approach these tasks with a will to work together, to abandon old prejudices, to realize that the world looks to us not to perpetuate animosities, but to heal the wounds and repair the damage, and give to all the peoples of the Near East the security they need and the security they long for, to make their lives tolerable and their future not a future of fear, but a future of hope.
Lord Caradan of Britain speaking at the United Nations today. When he spoke of the wounded and he spoke of the homeless, he called attention to the fact that both the governments of Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt have done a great disservice to the world. Not one of these governments has revealed the number of persons who have lost their lives in this short war. Not one has treated of the 1.25 million Arab refugees for whom American taxpayers are paying well over $100 million a year for rations. And those refugees are wandering tonight, pointing to their mouths to passing soldiers, asking for bread. The world truly needs peace. This is Morgan Beatty, NBC News.
This has been Crisis in the Middle East, a presentation of NBC News. This is the NBC Radio Network.